Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. The California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll find out why a decision this week could be a big step forward for California's high-speed rail project and what it means for the future of the coveted heavy maintenance facility, which promises to bring thousands of jobs to the area. We'll also talk to Bakersfield City Council member Andre Gonzalez about some new developments that could lead to a brighter future for downtown Bakersfield, and about that city's crackdown on marijuana dispensaries. Plus, Fresno Bee reporter Mackenzie Mays on her series about sex ed in Valley schools and about being singled out by a local school board member as being fake news after she published his comments about the LGBT community. All that's coming up, plus jazz singer Kevin Mahogany joins us. Right now, though, we begin with a look at a pressing health problem locally. A few weeks ago, we reported that the premature birth rate in the San Joaquin Valley is rising and that it's especially high in Fresno County. The numbers are concerning because premature babies are born with a higher risk of health complications like breathing difficulties, heart problems, and chronic disease. Decades of work have proven preterm births are tough to prevent, but FM 89's Carrie Klein reports that a new research initiative is up for the challenge.
So we're going to start right here.
Right here?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The
Edwards.
Edwards.
Reading is an everyday activity in Nicole Hutchings' home.
I don't know that word.
This bonding time between her and her son Adrian Lee is calm, peaceful, very different from the circumstances around Adrian's birth 6 years ago. Hutchings had been pregnant for about 32 weeks when she realized something was wrong. She noticed some strange symptoms and thought maybe her water had broken.
So I went in the hospital and they tested me and they said, yes, it's your amniotic fluid. And so doctor said to prep you for an emergency C-section.
Adrian's due date was still 8 weeks away. He wouldn't be considered full term for another 5. But Hutchings' doctors told her he'd be in danger if he wasn't delivered now.
I asked for a moment to pray.
Adrian was born just over 4.5 pounds. Hutchings barely met him before he was whisked into the neonatal intensive care unit.
I thought that I did something wrong, and I was questioning, what did I do?
Hutchings learned only later that premature births occur at a higher rate here in the San Joaquin Valley than almost anywhere else in the state. And she, as an African American woman, was at especially high risk. Local preterm birth rates have been a problem for years, but a cloud of mystery still surrounds the cause, and that uncertainty has spurred some new efforts to understand what's happening. According to state data, across California, about 9% of all live births are preterm, or earlier than 37 weeks. That's on par with the national average. Fresno County's preterm birth rate is more than 11%, the highest of any California county. Kern, Kings, and Merced counties aren't far behind. Within that data are other concerning trends. Shantae Davies is with the March of Dimes, a nonprofit that supports research into maternal health and birth outcomes.
What's really alarming and what's really a call to action is that we're seeing an increase in disparities between race and ethnicity.
This is true across the country, but the disparities are pronounced in Fresno County, where Black women may be as much as 75% more likely to have a preterm baby than white women. That rate stands out far beyond California.
When we compare ourselves to other countries, particularly some regions in Africa, we have very poor birth outcomes in the Central Valley.
This comparison comes up a lot. It's difficult to pin down precisely because every country calculates gestational age differently, but data do suggest Fresno County's African American preterm birth rate is in the ballpark of some of the poorest countries in the world. So why are we in such bad shape? theories abound, like women are waiting until later in life to get pregnant, and increased use of fertility technology can lead to more risky pregnancies. But that still doesn't explain what's different here. Enter UC San Francisco obstetrician Dr. Larry Rand.
It was very clear we have a massive epidemic on our hands, that and one that has seen no progress, and one that very clearly affects children's health, because it's the very beginning of life.
In 2015, Rand and a number of colleagues launched the Preterm Birth Initiative, a massive UCSF-sponsored partnership between health experts and community members. It's the very early stages of a 10-year program that aims to reduce preterm births through focused research and community interventions. In 2016, Fresno became one of the initiative's six focus areas in both California and sub-Saharan Africa. Rand says for decades, health agencies around the country tried to solve the problem by expanding mothers' access to health care. And overall, it didn't work. So Rand says the initiative is shifting its research focus to preconception and the more complex social determinants of health.
Where you live, how you live, what you're exposed to, you know, where you work, how hard do you work, how many jobs do you work, how do you get to those jobs? And frankly, all of it amounts to what is your level of chronic stress?
Fresno State's Sandra Flores is program director of the initiative's Fresno County arm. She's excited about this research because it's not just about crunching numbers in a database. It's about real people. Researchers are bringing parents of preterm babies into their workflow wherever they can, including their advisory committees.
That was a key distinction with the steering committee, that every facet of this initiative would have that expertise and the experience of a preterm birth.
That's a B.
B. Eh.
One of those experts is Nicole Hutchings. She sits on three committees that guide the Fresno County Preterm Birth Initiative. Through that work, she hopes she can ultimately help other moms be more informed than she was. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. For years, one of the most powerful and consistent Republican criticisms of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, is that monthly premiums are going up so fast they're quickly becoming unaffordable. Here is then-presidential candidate Donald Trump criticizing the premium increases during a debate with Democrat Hillary Clinton.
Obamacare has to go. The premiums are going up 60, 70, 80%. Next year, they're going to go up over 100%.
Trump, in part, rode a wave of anti-Obamacare sentiment all the way to the White House. While Republican plans for a full legislative repeal have stalled, that has not stopped the president from taking executive action to undermine the law. However, one action might have had the opposite effect, making Affordable Care Act plans more affordable for many in California. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports.
Following the collapse of the ACA repeal effort, President Trump began looking around for parts of the law he could change on his own. He settled on ending something called cost-sharing reduction payments. These are payments the law mandates the federal government give to insurance companies to bring down how much low-income people pay out of pocket for medical care. Here he is signing the executive order aiming at ending those payments.
For a long period of time since I started running, and since I became president of the United States, I just keep hearing repeal, replace, repeal, replace. Well, we're starting that process, and we're starting it in a very positive manner.
Trump has maligned the payments, calling them in turns illegal or insurance company bailouts. Ending them, he says, would be returning to the rule of law, even though the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says the move could make insurance more expensive. So it came as a surprise when Peter Lee, the executive director of the California health insurance marketplace called Covered California, said this during a swing through the Central Valley promoting the annual open enrollment period.
For people that get subsidies, 1.1 million Californians, tens of thousands of people in the Central Valley, their average premium of what they're going to spend for health coverage will drop in 2018. That's good news.
He says they expect 85% of people who buy their insurance on Covered California will pay less on their monthly premiums. So if the president, as he's often stated, wants the law to collapse and premiums do keep increasing, how did insurance actually get cheaper? To find out, I went to an Affordable Care Act enrollment site in central Fresno and met with insurance agent Mark Svetlik.
Even I was surprised, too. I thought that they might go up, you know, $20, $20 to $30, like they had in the previous years. However, this year they've increased the tax credit to offset the increase in the premium. And so that's allowed them to get, some of them, up to $30, $40 a month in premium savings.
Svetlik says his customers are shocked when they find out that the amount they pay each month will decrease, since so much coverage in the media has been about relentless increases. The key here, as Svetlik says, is that the amount the federal government is giving eligible Californians to buy their own insurance is going up. California runs its own insurance exchange, but the federal government pays the premium subsidies according to a formula. That formula is written into law and is beyond the administration's control. Amy Adams, with the California Healthcare Foundation, says the way the formula works is subsidies are calculated based on the cost of the second lowest silver plan in any market, called a benchmark plan. In anticipation of the Trump administration ending the cost-sharing reduction payments, the state of California added a surcharge onto that benchmark plan. That increased its cost, which in turn increased the federal subsidy for everyone eligible for one on the state exchange. How a consumer chooses to spend that money, Adams says, is up to them.
Now, people can take that subsidy. They can use it to buy a silver plan, or they can use it to buy a different level of plan, a gold plan, for example, on the marketplace. But it's true that the amount of the subsidy increases.
A brief but important note. Only the subsidy the federal government gives to consumers to buy insurance is increasing. This does lower what people pay per month, but it does not mean the core rate of premiums is declining, which is why not everyone will pay less. The Trump administration did not respond to requests for comment about the actions taken by the state or whether they'll act in any way to prevent those subsidies from increasing. However, they did not deny that the subsidies will increase, nor did they dispute the cause. Anthony Wright is with Health Access California, which supports the ACA. He says this might all sound like a good thing. More money means people can access more affordable health insurance. But in the long run, this extraordinary workaround by the state only destabilizes the market right around the time insurance companies were beginning to figure it out.
It is a bad thing in that it introduces more complexity and confusion into our healthcare system, which was already complex enough. Thank you very much.
Complexity aside, the bottom line is many people in California on the exchange will likely have the option to pay less for their insurance when they do their shopping this year. Enrollment is open now through the end of January. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Fresno Bee reporter Mackenzie Mays has just wrapped up a 9-month-long reporting project about the problems with sex education curriculum in Valley schools. It's a reporting project that's also put her in the headlines as a lot of controversy erupted from an exchange with school board president of Fresno Unified's Board of Trustees, Brooke Ashton. I want to talk about that in a little bit, Mackenzie, and the response that you've received from the community and also from the journalism world, as this has been a very interesting story. The USC reporting on health group just wrote about this, and I know others are interested in those issues, and we're going to get to that in a bit, but I think we should also focus on the bulk of your reporting. We had you on our program a while ago when this series started, looking at the problems here. You were trying to determine whether sex education courses in the Valley were really living up to the state law. What did you find?
Yeah, so the first story we did was in July, and actually I'm writing one more
okay.
this week, but it's pretty close to done. And we found out that not only did a lot of students say that they didn't feel like they were talking about sex enough in school, which is now the law, and the law is pretty specific about what you should learn about sex in school, but we also learned that teen parents didn't feel supported. We heard stories about young teen mothers feeling shamed out of their schools by the administration and having to take city buses for long rides because they weren't accommodated otherwise in a traditional setting. And we tried to pick at the issue from every direction. We even calculated teen birth rates by every zip code in Fresno County, and were able to point out how disparate the teen birth rates were, even within minutes of each high school. It was pretty staggering.
Now, we have a couple of clips of audio I want to play. Tell us about how you gathered these. You talked to a lot of different teens. You talked to adults, school board leaders, et cetera. But these listening posts, tell us about this.
Yeah, this was part of the USC fellowship, and a big part of that is community engagement. And so we set up these listening posts, which are pretty simple, just like poster board and a recorder, and it allowed teens to anonymously talk about their experiences.
Let's go ahead and listen to this first one. This is about whether the services and the education that schools have been providing was comprehensive. These were recorded where? On what schools?
None at schools, mostly after-school programs,
but
so
it's
in Fresno and Visalia. So
these are local districts. This particular one is Fresno Unified, because it's saying that this was not comprehensive. Was it Fresno or Visalia?
It's either. I'll have to hear it first.
All right, well, let's go ahead and listen.
I was frustrated with how we were taught the sex ed. Basically, everything we learned in the class for health and wellness, we learned straight out of the textbook, and it's a pretty outdated textbook. We had like a old PE coach just like babysit us as we filled out our assignments from the textbook, and it was not helpful at all, nor comprehensive. It was very basic. I did get a lot of abstinence-only vibes from the readings, and it wasn't helpful at all.
So again, this idea that the state law that requires comprehensive sex education hasn't, at least until recent times, been fully implemented. Is that changing in any way?
Yeah, so what we just heard was a recent graduate in Visalia, actually. So it very well could be that the law wasn't in place when she had these classes, but that wasn't really the point. Was, you know, it wasn't to get anyone in trouble for not following the law, per se. It was to show how far we have to go. So Fresno Unified did adopt the curriculum. They have to. And parents can still opt out if that's their choice, but we surveyed students in Fresno Unified to ask, you know, we pulled a majority of the survey questions were exactly from state law language about what they're learning. And we found out that a lot of them were not, you know, had not learned so far what they will learn, you know, the next cohort of students, what they'll learn under the law.
The issue of sexual assault, sexual abuse is also in the news nationally right now with the Me Too movement and all the allegations that have come out recently. Is that being addressed in the curriculum? And I want to play this clip in a second, but what do we know about how that fits into this discussion? Is that something that students are receiving any education on at the school level?
Yeah, that's part of the curriculum. California was the first state to adopt a law that require schools to teach about consent and about rape and about healthy relationships. And that's sort of the pinnacle. So if you look at the curriculum, as the students get older, they take on heavier subjects. And, you know, in high school, that's definitely a focus, is how is this relationship healthy, and what can you do to respond if it's not?
Let's go ahead and listen to what one local student had to say about that.
In the classes, they don't really teach you about, not too much, they don't teach you about like how to maintain or how to get a healthy relationship, how to know if you're in a toxic one, and if so, how to help get out of there. Where's all your resources to help you out if you ever need anything? And I find it kind of sad that I feel like I can't turn to any of the adult allies I have in my life, whether it be my parents, my teachers, uncles, aunts, anyone. I can't turn to anyone about these questions.
So again, just one of the comments you've received from students that you talked to as part of this, or recent graduates. Mackenzie Mays with the Fresno Bee joining us today. Mackenzie, what has the community response been like to this story? And I mean the totality of the response. We know that, and I want to get into School Board President Brooke Ashton's comments in a bit, but what has the overall response been, positive and negative?
I think it's mostly been positive. It's interesting because everyone sort of knew that teen pregnancy was an issue in the Central Valley because it's been a problem for so long. Six of the 10 highest teen birth rates in California are here in the Valley. So, but it was kind of like we held a mirror up to the issues, and we were actually able to tell the stories of youth who were going through it currently or who had just lived it. The first story we told about a 14-year-old teen mom, you know, it resulted in a GoFundMe of more than $4,000 being raised to help her get a car and an apartment because her story was so moving. And so mostly it was just, I think it was nice for people to, instead of talk about youth and teen parents, to actually hear directly from them, whether that was in the stories or in a listening post.
So, of course, we have to address this, the elephant in the room, the big issue here. In one of the early stories in this report, you quoted Fresno Unified School Board President Brooke Ashen as saying the following about his own personal views about sex education and inclusion of curriculum, including LGBT issues. And this is a direct quote here. My biggest fear in teaching this, which we're going to do it because it's the law, but you have kids who are extremely moldable at this stage. And if you start telling them that LGBT is okay and that it's a way of life, well, maybe you just swayed the kid to go that way. Ashen is a devout Mormon, and he took issue with that statement. I want to ask you bluntly here, did you accurately quote him in that statement?
Yes, of course I did.
Now, one of the things that confuses me about this is Ashen has criticized you personally, directly, in a way that may be commonplace now in Washington with the way that President Trump addresses reporters, but it's rather unusual here in this area. Is he, I don't recall him actually, though, saying that he doesn't believe those things. It seems like he's saying that he was misquoted, but he's in some ways doubling down on what he is saying. Has he recanted those statements in any way?
I think in some ways, yeah. It's been a few months and it's sort of changed. But, you know, the story that he was quoted in originally was an important story to tell. It would have been a huge omission in the series to not acknowledge these feelings of conservative politicians and how they feel personally, whether it's religion or not, about sex ed. But he initially said that he was taken out of context, and then later in emails that we got through public records requests seemed to really own those statements and has owned them pretty publicly about how he feels.
So where does this go from here? He's also questioned your reporting on the survey. How was that addressed from your perspective? Did you go through the proper channels there?
Yeah, the survey was anonymous and voluntary, and we had to get it approved by the district and meet with them a few times and wait a few weeks for it to get all the right eyes on it before we were allowed to meet with student leaders to tell them about the survey and help them, you know, ask them to spread the word about it. So, yeah, if there's any education reporters listening, you can't do much these days without getting district approval. So,
how hard has it been on you?
It's been hard. I've really tried to avoid to be part of the story because I'm not the story. I'm the storyteller. And so my editors have been really supportive, and honestly, readers too. A lot of people have reached out to me and told me to keep fighting the good fight, so it's okay.
Again, Mackenzie Mays with the Fresno Bee joining us to talk about this series on sex ed. This last story, what general direction? I don't want you to scoop yourself here, but what can we expect to see in the Bee coming up?
Yeah, so this is the great thing about community engagement is I don't think the story would have existed if I wouldn't have been, you know, on the ground reporting like I was and meeting new people. But I kept hearing that teen dads were left out of the equation, and that teen boys in general didn't feel like they were getting proper sex ed or just not, you know, being told about the responsibilities of young parenthood. So this story, hopefully running this weekend, is about teen dads and about a really impressive teen father in Fresno and what we can do to support boys in the conversations as well.
Mackenzie Mays with the Fresno Bee. Her series on sex ed is available online at fresnobee.com. Mackenzie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And stay with us on Valley Edition. We'll be back in just a moment and find out why there's a big decision looming for California's high-speed rail system. Who's going to run the trains? That could play into who and what community gets the heavy maintenance facility. Also, Bakersfield City Council member Andre Gonzalez joins us. That's all coming up on Valley Edition. The board of the California High-Speed Rail Authority is set to vote on awarding a $30 million contract to a company from Europe to be the rail line's early train operator. The vote tomorrow might not be a huge financial part of the $64 billion project, but it could also mark a big turning point for the rail line. Here to tell us more about this vote and what it means for the Valley is our own Jeffrey Hess. Jeffrey, welcome.
Good day.
What do we know about this company that the Rail Authority staff has recommended to be the one that's actually selected to get this contract? They're from Germany, I take it.
Yeah, they're called Deutsche Bahn AG. Everyone calls them DB because it's obviously German. They have run and overseen the German high-speed rail for quite some time. And the way they're portrayed is that they have a lot of experience, but because of how they have done their rail line, they're not as flexible as some of the other agencies were offering, but they are the ones that a lot of people think could deliver on a big priority, which is making sure that the line here can run either at a slight profit or just not at a loss. Because it's important to remember the bond measure that started all of this does not allow for the rail to run with any type of government subsidy.
So essentially they're saying this company knows how to do this. They've done it before in other countries. What were some of the other companies in the running?
There was a Spanish company named Renfe, who a lot of people thought was going to be a big player. Part of the reason they were seen as such an important part is they have a global presence, and the Spanish government makeup is a lot more like the California government makeup than the Germans are. At the same time, there was also an Italian company that was involved. They are generally considered to be the last among the preferable groups, but they had a lot of creative options because they had to compete in ways that the bigger ones couldn't. And lastly, there was a Chinese company. The Chinese have the world's largest high-speed rail line in their country. It's absolutely massive. The difficulty there was there's a lot of cultural differences between the West and California specifically regarding our environmental laws and the Chinese government officials who are more accustomed to just doing what they want when they want. And in California, that's not how we operate.
Yeah, that's one of the things that in some ways may slow down the eventual deployment of this. What does the early train operator actually do? Are they going to be running trains, actually operating trains, or is that still further off down the line?
It's a ways down the line, but they will be doing the initial segment, the segment that's going to run from Bakersfield to San Jose. So they'll be overseeing the trains that run that and literally operating the line, doing the day-to-day, making sure the trains arrive on time, making sure everybody's safe, making sure maintenance is up to code. If you're sending a train at 200 miles an hour, you want to make sure it stays on the tracks.
But there's a lot of things that have to happen before we get to that point, aside from just the construction of the line, which is underway right now in about 110-mile stretch at various points throughout the valley right now. What are the other things they're planning on doing?
Some of the other things they're planning on doing is they'll have a say in where the heavy maintenance facility is going to be built. That's the place where the trains will be maintained. This is a big project that a lot of cities in the Central Valley have been competing over. That's a big one. They're also going to have a say in the literal design of the trains, how the trains operate. And so the thinking of the High Speed Rail Authority is that if you're going to hand over authority to a company, you want that company to be comfortable with the technology that you're asking them to work with, rather than the other way around. You don't want the state of California picking whatever they want and deciding, all right, company, you make it work. Instead, they're saying, you've done this before, Germany, DB. You've made these lines work. You've done things like drill through incredibly seismic active areas in the German countryside. You've made it work. Come in here and make it work for us.
And that's going to be a key issue there now. As you mentioned, the heavy maintenance facility is key for many of the communities here in the valley that are hoping to land it. Specifically, Fresno County and Kern County probably have the best chance of landing that. There are a few others, Merced and Madera, that also hope to have a shot there. But this could bring some estimates as many as 2,300 jobs, permanent jobs, not including the construction of the facility. What's the status of actually awarding that? Because I think I remember hearing a few years ago that it was already supposed to be awarded by now.
Yeah, they were expecting to be awarded earlier this year. I think the delay in selecting the initial operator had a lot to do with them holding off on making that decision. They want this company to have a say in where that's going to be. There's a lot of advantages for whatever company is going to be selected long term if they're selected as the initial operator. This is a short-term contract. It's only 6 years. Long-term, they're looking at 25 or 30-year contract later on, and whoever's operating it now initially will have not necessarily a guarantee of that long-term contract, but will obviously have a big advantage if they've run the first segment of it and can prove they can do it successfully.
Do local officials have any idea of when the decision on the site of that heavy maintenance facility might be made now going forward?
If they do, the track record would be an indication that they don't know well, because everyone who's told me for the last 3 years has been pretty consistently mistaken about when that decision is going to be made or where it's going to be made. So obviously there's a lot of local officials from both sides of the aisle, both Democrats and Republicans, who are looking at their communities and thinking 2,300 high quality, high paying jobs is what they really want. And so once the High Speed Rail Authority makes their decision, then local officials will have a lot better of idea of who they're trying to tailor their message to.
So, Jeffrey, I understand it's not just operating the trains that is an issue that maybe this German company might have some expertise in. The issue of terrorism is something that has also come up, and responding and designing the line and the stations with that in mind is something they're looking at. What have people told you about that?
There is one thing that you want to keep in mind that the High Speed Rail Authority is thinking about that a lot of people might not be thinking about, and that's the safety of the line. And I don't just mean that the trains run safely or that the passengers aren't being mean to each other. They're thinking about the threat of terrorism. And so they want an agency that is comfortable with responding to keeping these trains and the rail lines safe in the event of an outside malicious force. So as unfortunate as it is, the presence of terrorism is also playing a role in deciding who's going to operate this line.
Well, it sounds like a big turning point for the project again. The vote set for tomorrow on the contract to be the first operator, the early operator of the California high-speed rail train system. And it could play a significant role in what community or where gets the high. And it could play a significant part in the decision of what community gets the heavy maintenance facility and how it's designed. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess with us today. Jeffrey, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. It's been an eventful first year on the Bakersfield City Council for Andre Gonzalez. He represents Ward 2, which includes Westchester and downtown. The 24th Street project is moving forward despite a lengthy legal battle. High-speed rails, plans for a station at the north end of downtown seem like they're moving forward. And the same for a new plan that hopes to shape the future vision for the downtown area. There's also news about parks, parking, and more. Andre Gonzalez joins us now on Valley Edition. Andre, welcome.
Thank you, sir. Good morning.
Before we get to the downtown issues and things like high-speed rail, I want to start out with something that's been in the news lately and that's really divided many in the community, this issue of the legalization statewide of marijuana, or at least right now in Bakersfield, the ban on marijuana dispensaries, which you voted for last month. Many of these dispensaries that the city recently closed down were in your district. The city conducted this big sweep. They were illegal before. How confident are you that the city has the resources and manpower to ensure they don't pop up again?
Well, two things. One thing is the city just enacted an ordinance that banned and prohibited adult use cannabis sales, distribution, and manufacturing within the city of Bakersfield. We know that statewide, the use of cannabis is now legal, but our scope was looking at the adult use sales and distribution within the city. Prior to that, in 2013, the city council enacted an ordinance that prohibited medical marijuana dispensaries, and yet we have seen the proliferation of dispensaries throughout Bakersfield and really throughout Kern County. And you're right, Ward 2 has seen the highest number of these dispensaries, which was of great concern to me and to many others, because while I certainly support access to medicinal marijuana and I recognize the need, there certainly is no doubt that many of these dispensaries are doing much more and have much more nefarious activities than just medicinal use. And so we have enacted a civil fine process that will incur a civil penalty for not only the dispensary, but also for property owners of $1,000 a day. And that has proven to be very effective. We've seen property owners serving eviction notices to many dispensaries throughout the downtown area. and throughout one of the most special neighborhoods of Oleander in Bakersfield because of this civil fine process.
Now, last week, Supervisor Mike Magger with Kern County floated an idea that maybe the county should explore something like allowing mobile delivery services for marijuana patients. Do you think that's something that the city could potentially look at as well? How open are you to revisiting this issue in some way and maybe allowing some sort of access, or is this the final word?
No, I don't think it's the final word. Look, a ban can always be reversed. And it's important for us to recognize the reason why many of us, particularly myself, really voted in favor of a ban right now. We're up against the deadline of January 1 before the state begins issuing licenses to dispensaries. And so we had to develop some sort of formal regulation or a ban before that time. And we just weren't at the place yet to develop regulations. And so my hope is to work with my colleagues on the council and with the city manager and the city attorney to develop regulations that will work for the city of Bakersfield. So certainly I've spoken with Supervisor Maggard on a number of occasions, and as well as my colleagues on the council level to discuss what that means for Bakersfield in the future. And I'm confident that we'll get there, but it'll take some time.
There's a lot of things brewing under the surface downtown with the city of Bakersfield and in the terms of planning for the future. One of those things came to a head last week as High Speed Rail issued its updated environmental impact report for the new route and the new station site, the preferred route and station site by the city of Bakersfield. Looks like that's moving forward. There have been persistent critics, though, of that location up in the northern part of downtown, right off of Golden State. People saying that that's not the best place to put the station. It's not as close to the downtown core. How confident are you that is the right option for Bakersfield and for your downtown district?
I'm fairly confident that that's the right venue. I mean, if you look at the area around F Street and Golden State, you'll notice there are a lot of vacant buildings, vacant properties, a lot of depressed commercial areas that could use some revitalization. And high-speed rail and the high-speed rail station is nothing more than an economic engine. And I look at this as an opportunity to really invest and redevelop that section of the downtown area. And so I see this as an opportunity. And the more and more I talk to residents who live in Westchester and around that area, the more they recognize this is an opportunity to see economic development and community revitalization and less of a nuisance.
Speaking of the high-speed rail station, that kicked off another planning process that the city has undertaken to revision the scope and activities in downtown Bakersfield. It kicked off back all the way in 2016. It had been scheduled to come to the council later this year. What's the status of the Making Downtown Bakersfield project? Last big meeting you had was back in March of this year. What's going on there, and what is that plan hoping to do?
Well, you're right. I mean, over 16 months, hundreds of residents and stakeholders of the downtown area have met to really envision a better downtown. And certainly over the last 10 years, there have been a lot of efforts to revitalize our downtown that are now paying off. And so now it's really the opportunity for us to look at how can we make our downtown high-speed rail ready. And in the event that high-speed rail does not come into fruition anytime soon, how do we make our downtown the economic engine and driver for all of us throughout Bakersfield? And so it has been really an exciting opportunity to hear from different residents and to come up with some real strategies, including the development of a property-based improvement district among downtown property owners, including looking at strategies to increase the number of housing units within the downtown core. So those ideas are already in formation and we're working towards. But the actual vision document is still in draft form and will likely come to the council within the next couple of months.
What are the biggest obstacles that you hear from people in the private sector who maybe have the ability or interest to get something done? Are they pointing to anything in particular that, like, hey, you know, Andre, we need to fix this. We could really make a lot more progress if the city or if property owners or anybody just did X, Y, and Z. Are there identifiable things that maybe you can move the lever on a little bit from City Hall and your perspective there? Or is it just a larger economic issue?
Well, I think first and foremost, we know that infill development is far more expensive than developing outside on the outskirts on farmland. Number two is parking becomes a big issue when you start looking at the parking requirements for any future development. So those two things right away are big economic hurdles to overcome. But beyond that, we have to remain in contact with developers, and I'm working with lots of them to search out those who have a heart for the downtown and to really work on projects that not only will be economically viable and will reward the developer, but also something that's a labor of love for people. And we're seeing some good examples. The 17-place townhomes on 18th Street, for example, developed 44 market-rate townhomes. We cut the ribbon on this project in January of this year. The average rent is around $1,600 a month. They are completely leased, 100%, and in fact have a waiting list of people wanting to get into these units. So it is probably the premier apartment complex in all of Bakersfield. And that's exciting because it indicates that people of all ages, all walks of life, from millennials to retirees, people with families to single individuals, want to live in an urban setting, want to live in our downtown core. So we have to create those conditions to make it more viable for developers to come in and to do that. And in fact, now the city council adopted a new goal this year during our goal setting process to double the population of downtown from 5,000 currently to 10,000 by the year 2030. And so we're working towards that and identifying those specific issues so that we can help developers develop downtown.
You mentioned parking as an issue. The city just a couple of months ago initiated another study on that very topic, downtown Bakersfield parking and how to get more of it or how to price it better or any of those things. What is the problem there? Why not just let the private sector deal with it? If somebody needs more parking, build it on their property or build a garage. Is the city going to get into building more garages? Is that the intent or is this what is the intent of that study?
Could be. It could be another garage. You know, our current parking garage for the very first time is actually turning a profit. This is a city-owned garage off of 18th Street and I. And that has been really encouraging to see this parking structure really move towards being very accessible and much more accessible, I should say, and much more popular for people to use. But still, in certain sections of downtown, we have a parking problem. Too many people want to come downtown. That's a good problem to have, by the way. But certainly, as we look at adding additional housing units, adding additional amenities to the downtown area, we have to make sure that parking is resolved. And we can't just expect the property owner or developers to resolve that issue. And as you know, parking structures are expensive. So we have to look at what do we have already in our existing inventory that in our downtown core, not only that's owned by the city, but also by private property owners, but also other governmental agencies, for example, the county or the Kern County Superintendent of Schools. And how do we coordinate the inventory so that we can allow for additional parking in the when those structures are not being used. In addition to that, we want to look at different ways that we can design street parking so that we can add more capacity to the parking issue in downtown. So we like to look at all sides, not just the current need and demand for parking, but also the future demand as we see development in the downtown core.
Before we close, I want to go from parking to parks. You've been a big advocate for pocket parks. This is something that's happening in a lot of communities across the country. You want to make it happen in East Bakersfield. What's going on there?
Yeah, so through a nonprofit I started about 5 years ago when I was the a school board member on the Bakersfield City School District, we started a nonprofit called Children First Campaign. And through that nonprofit, we raised over $200,000 to develop a 16,000 square foot pocket park in East Bakersfield on Monterey and Niles Streets. And this area around Williams Elementary School is a low-income area, certainly in need of amenities. And also, it's well noted that within this area, there's high rates of chronic conditions such as heart disease, diabetes, asthma. And so it's important for us to give amenities or to provide these amenities for the families in the area. So Children First has raised this money within, I think, within that neighborhood. There's there are no green spaces for families to walk around or to get exercise. In fact, the closest park is about a mile away from this particular neighborhood. And so we want to create this green space so that families can enjoy it. They can come out and spend time with one another, spend time with their neighbors. We also see this space as a way to activate community projects and gatherings to really build that sense of community within the neighborhood. So we're pretty excited about it. We're breaking ground pretty quickly and hope to have this park open by summertime.
Really quickly before we go, one last thing, the 24th Street project I mentioned right at the start. How confident are you that you're going to find some sort of workable solution for pedestrian access there? We had a guest on last week from Vision Zero Kern who was concerned about that issue, and I know many residents in Westchester are as well. That's been a controversial and long-running project, but how confident are you there's a solution there, and what might that look like?
Yeah, so the issue there on 24th Street was the issue of a crosswalk on A Street and Alder that was too close to a merging lane that made it too unsafe for a crosswalk to exist there. I've been a big proponent of walkability, and in particular, this crosswalk has been very important to me, as well as Vice Mayor Smith from Ward 4. And so he and I have been working on this for the past 7 to 8 months. We've heard from residents throughout Westchester that this crosswalk is very important to them. And so we're working with engineers. City Council voted to require the engineers to come back with a design for a crosswalk on 24th Street. Now, where that is and what that looks like is still up in the air, but it will certainly be a signalized crosswalk that will protect individuals.
A lot of exciting things happening in the works for downtown Bakersfield and residents in that area. Andre Gonzalez represents Ward 2 on the Bakersfield City Council joining us today. Thank you so much, Andre.
Thank you, Joe. I appreciate the opportunity.
It's too late. Don't come knocking on my door. It's too late.
You're listening to Valley Edition. He's been called the standout male jazz singer of his generation. Kevin Mahogany's rich baritone is equally at home singing romantic ballads or on up-tempo bebop numbers. While his influences range from Motown to Charlie Parker, he's been one of the top jazz vocalists for the last 3 decades. And he's performing at Fresno's Tower Theater this Saturday at 8 p.m. A few days ago, FM 89's David Ouse, host of our Sunday Night Jazz program, spoke with Kevin over the phone to learn a little more about his career and what Valley audiences can expect with his concert.
Hello and welcome, Kevin Mahogany.
Hey, hello, how are you doing?
All right, great to have you with us. We live in an era in which a lot of singers and aspiring vocalists are exposed to things like The Voice and Idol. Coming from the jazz tradition, what opportunities do you have to offer something different from those, and what challenges do young vocalists face who are wanting to learn jazz, but all they've seen is singing from in the style of Idol and things like that?
Well, I mean, those shows are okay for some things, but there's a lot of things, yeah, that you end up missing, not just jazz vocals, but all vocalists end up missing because there are very few, if any, places that actually teach it. And as silly as it may sound, but we're talking things like enunciation and interpretation of lyrics and of tunes and basic things like that that we found to be very important in jazz, they don't relish as much in contemporary music. So working with those things helps develop not only a better artist, but a better musician. That's part of what I work with, as well as microphone technique and performance techniques and performance issues that a lot of people don't get to study other than just what they see on TV.
When you were coming up and developing your style and your approach, who were singers that affected you the most, and what did you learn from them?
Well, you'd be surprised. Part of a lot of my background is also instrumental, which helped me a lot. Believe it or not, helped me a lot in separating the separation of notes and understanding of lyrics, believe me. So most of the local artists that I was hearing at that time were the ones who were influencing me more, because I wasn't a big TV watcher back then, and radio was a different animal at that time. You know, formats were completely different. I sometimes think that's what was best for me, because I didn't just listen to jazz shows or just pop shows back then. A radio format might play, the Beatles tune, and then the next thing they play the Temptations, and then the next time they might play Donny Hathaway, and you know, they play so many different people back to back that you weren't just listening to one style of an artist. And so I got to compare people, singers, on the radio just by listening. A lot of the local artists that I heard here, instrumental and vocalists in my home, actually made an impression upon me, because they also took me under their wing and told me, or helped me to learn, again, what was important in a song. That it's not just the melody. Like I said, it's the story, it's the lyrics, it's how you tell your story, and painting pictures with the words that makes a difference that you have that no one else has.
Now, speaking of telling a story, your newest album, you really take a new step in telling your own story, because you crafted tunes yourself for this record.
Yes. It's my first effort at doing a majority of the material myself, yeah. The title is part of the inspiration, because I was in Vienna when I wrote a lot of these songs, and I recorded it with a Viennese group, and it's just my chance to try my hand at telling a few stories, some of them humorous, and some of them a little different, but it's a lot of fun for me to take a chance and open up that way.
The name of the album is, of course, Vienna Affair. It's on the Cracked an Egg record label. And we're talking with vocalist Kevin Mahogany, who will be in performance in Fresno on Saturday, November 18th at the Tower Theater. You've also done a record inspired by the John Coltrane, Johnny Hartman legendary recording, and you've been compared often to Johnny Hartman. What do you love about Johnny Hartman, and what do you think listeners should know about Johnny Hartman and his music?
Johnny Hartman is one of those vocalists that tells the story. You can actually hear the story in his song and in the way he sings it and puts those songs together. Him and Coltrane was an excellent pairing because descriptiveness of the material through word and instrument. I mean, it's just incredible. And so I just try and touch a part of what he did emotion-wise as far as performing of those materials so that people, again, can... The object for me is so that they can feel like they've been touched by the vocalist, that I'm singing their song or their story. And that's what I got from him a lot, was how to interpret that song.
Do you approach things differently when you're playing with a big band, large ensemble, versus a trio?
Well, the trio is obviously a more intimate setting. In other words, just the three of you, three people and the vocalist. The smaller the ensemble, of course, the more intimate it is. In other words, the less things that are getting in the way, I guess is the best way to say it. And with the big band, not saying everyone's getting in the way, it's basically it's the accompaniment, the background, that makes a difference in how the material is interpreted as well. Even though a ballad can still be a ballad, but it's how it's interpreted by the background that the instrumentalists are bringing to it in a big band setting. So it makes it a little more fun for you as the vocalist, because you have these other options. If you're just doing a duo, it's going to be intimate, but not a whole lot you can do, because you have to make sure you deliver that story. But with the big band, you also have a few other things that you can bounce off of rhythmically or harmonically, so you're allowed to do a few other things and have a fun experience with the group as well.
Do you have any favorite tracks off the new album?
Well, one of my favorites is That's Why Old Men Sing the Blues. Again, it's just a little explanatory situation of why it seems like the older gentlemen seem to sing the blues more so.
I sit at home all by myself, no one to talk to, not even a pet. Young girls think I'm too old, mature women think I'm too bold. But let me give you the news, that's why old men sing the blues.
Blues are such a vital part of jazz. How do you work with younger singers to help infuse them with the feeling and knowledge of the blues in an era that's ruled by dance beats and different musical influences?
It's difficult for a lot of them, but you have to go back and learn. You have to go back and listen to some of these other things. And like you said, for me, you can't have jazz without blues and vice versa. And if you listen to them, you can see why and understand again, going back for the vocalist, going back to the story within and how it's told from a blues standpoint, from a jazz standpoint, they work hand in hand. And so sometimes you have to encourage them to actually go back and listen. But the funny thing is usually when they do go back and listen, they are pleasantly surprised at how much they enjoy it. It's just a matter that they've never been exposed to it before. It tends to work out well if you give them that guidance. It's just like learning the history of any instrument or any country or anything like that. That's part of the history of this music. And you got to have a part of it, be a part of it to make the future work for you.
Well, that says it very well. Thanks so much for joining us today, Kevin Mahogany.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it very much. I'm looking forward to, like I said, coming out and running into old friends and meeting some new people and just having a great time.
And that does it for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. You can send us an email, talk@kvpr.org, send us a tweet, @kvpr and @Valley Edition, and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and all the other social media sites. Find them all on our link on our social media page at kvpr.org. And while you're at it, download our new mobile app for Android and Apple devices. It's available on the App Store and Google Play. Just search KVPR. For Valley Edition's reporting crew of Carrie Klein, Jeffrey Hess, and Laura Tsutsui, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. The California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.